Beetroot juice, used by Olympic athletes for its stamina-boosting effects, caused waves at the last Olympics. Clinical studies proved 2 glasses of beetroot juice per day could increase stamina by 16%. I've been using it, and this product is excellent. Beets are a nutrition goldmine, so call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeets.com. Get a 30-day supply free. That's 800-738-2198 or intelligentbeets.com. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin to answer your questions. Remember, you can send us questions whenever you like to radio program, one word, radio program at AOL.com. And please make your questions concise and pithy and to the point. And I have to say, you know, I got an inquiry on, I'll give you an example of one that we couldn't answer.
Yeah.
Somebody wrote to me on Facebook, "Dear Dr. Hoffman, I'm tired, I'm depressed, I'm in menopause, and it's like, is there any vitamins I can take?" And, you
know, that's a consult.
I mean, I can understand the person wanting help.
Sure.
But it's just that's a consult. The answers would be very individualized, or else we'd have to do a whole graduate seminar,
yeah.
You know, perhaps an entire weekend workshop on what goes into menopause and what are some of the possible causes for fatigue. And
that's a good idea.
You know, I mean, that's a good idea. We do that. We just did one on, you know, cravings and how to overcome your cravings. And by the way, video will be available. We're now editing the video, so it'll be available to listeners who couldn't attend live. So look, you know, keep checking drhoffman.com for the announcement about the availability of the video.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain questions. I mean, just trying to say that questions that are overly general or ask for very detailed help with a complex medical problem just don't lend themselves to this format. But we've had good questions. They're very narrowly focused.
Yeah. Now, speaking of consults, if I may veer just for a moment.
Yes, go.
To become a patient at the Hoffman Center, to come see Dr. Hoffman, you need to come in physically, get a physical, see him, all of that.
Let me tell you why. You know, some people say, "Look, Dr. Hoffman, I'd like to consult with you, but I'm in whatever Tennessee."
Yeah.
And you know, and but I have to say that because of medical legal rules, it is hard for me to take responsibility for a patient that I haven't seen. Now this is changing. There is increasingly telemedicine and internet medicine, but you know, frequently there are all kinds of you know, legal disclaimers about what to do. And I want, you know, when I'm taking responsibility for a patient, I'm really taking responsibility for a patient. So I want to physically see the patient at least once. I have to come here. I have to physically examine them, or my physician assistant examines them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we do the whole medical workup. And I'm sorry, that's what we have to do. But somebody says, "Well, let's have a couple questions about what vitamins to take." I'm sorry, I can't do that. But segue to your situation.
I'm a nutritionist. I'm not a doctor. I have clients all over the country that I do phone consultations with. It is not required that you have a full medical physical when you see me. It's a nutrition consult, which is very different.
So your scope is more narrow.
Very narrow. It's based on your diet, your supplements. Yes, I take a medical history, but this can all be done over the phone. I would request your most recent labs. I'm talking about the basic labs, a comprehensive metabolic panel, a complete blood count, things of that nature. And I would also follow up to say, let's also check your vitamin D. Let's also check your B12, your homocysteine, see what's going on there. But I have clients, speaking of Tennessee, I've got one in Tennessee. I've got in Georgia, as far away as Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
Yeah, we welcome telephone consults here. If you want more information, please call our office, and our staff can tell you all about it, 212-779-1744.
Right, and that's an important route by which people can get some of the expertise which we share.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, we've been working together. How long have we worked together?
I got here, October 2005.
So you already had your 10th anniversary.
Yeah.
We blew it. We didn't have like a big blowout for that.
Well, 10th anniversary will actually happen October.
Oh, okay.
It'll be October.
I thought we dodged a bullet on that. Okay. Okay, now that I know. All right, so coming up 10th anniversary. So, but you know, so basically we, you know, share the same approach, and I'm
yes.
always available sometimes for a kitchen consult if you know, or you know, water cooler conversation if you know, there's
yeah.
something that's particularly vexing mm-hmm. about your case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So our question is from Bo. I just had a diagnosis of C. diff. I'm on Flagyl and all my symptoms have gone away. Bo was having a lot of bloating, pale, loose stools, anxiety, weight gain for the last 7 years. And any time he's been put on antibiotics, he felt better. But then as he comes off, the symptoms return. Well, now he was diagnosed with C. diff given Flagyl.
Could it have been that that was C. diff all along?
Possibly.
Oh.
What do you think? Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow.
Why is this happening? He just wants to know that his symptoms will finally go away.
Well, you know, I wish it were that simple. You know, the problem with C. diff, first of all, you know, what is C. diff? C. difficile, you know, implicit in the name is it's difficult.
Yeah.
You know, in French yeah. and in Spanish, difficile means difficult. And Clostridium is a species that includes, botulinum. Toxin.
You know, Botox injections?
Right.
Yeah.
Which is fatal. But actually, it turns out that there's good Clostridia, just like there's good E.
Yes.
coli. And in fact, it's good to have Clostridial species. So it's mm-hmm. it's like, you know, Clostridium difficile is sort of the pit bull of, you know, of
yeah.
the bacterial kingdom where, you know, it's a variant on what is usually a helpful species.
Mm-hmm.
It is contagious. It's very hard to scrub down a hospital room. You know, if you even, like, clean it with Lysol, sometimes there are tiny spores which are very resistant. That's why it's now becoming epidemic
yeah.
in hospital. And many people check into hospitals for one thing or another, and they, you know, nothing related to gastrointestinal, they come out with a C. difficile infection.
Yeah.
Also, antibiotics cause C. difficile to
yes.
occur.
Yes, so, now that's more rampant, isn't
yeah.
it?
Just yeah, absolutely. Just, so just taking antibiotics puts you at risk. And there are actually cases of people who just put topical antibiotics on their face for acne, like
uh-huh.
clindamycin. It gets into the system, and it creates C. difficile.
Oh, my goodness.
So how do you know you have C. diff? It's, you know, usually you have bad diarrhea and wasting, weight loss, and malaise.
Yeah.
And it's tough to get rid of because early on it was treated with Flagyl, but it became resistant to Flagyl. Then they started adding vancomycin, which they didn't want to give very much because they didn't want to shoot their wad on vancomycin responsiveness. You
mm-hmm.
develop, you know, the more you use an antibiotic, the less effective it becomes. But
yeah.
now vancomycin has become ineffective against it. What's interesting is that the treatment that seems to really work for it...
Specific carbohydrate diet?
Well, that can help.
Okay.
It helps, but the treatment that really seems to turn the corner is fecal transfer.
Oh, yeah.
Fecal transfer, which is the only medical condition for which fecal transfer is now permitted and established. It's past the research stage, and it's now being... done, but not the first line. Usually, they say, well, let's make sure that you don't, you know, you respond to antibiotics.
Yeah.
And, you know, many of our patients who've had C. difficile get better without the fecal transfer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating that just one or two fecal transfers from a healthy donor can completely cure this because it normalizes your intestinal bacteria.
What's involved in a fecal transfer?
Well, what's involved is, first of all, most importantly, a healthy donor. So the donor has to be screened with, you know, questionnaires and with stool tests and with blood tests to make sure that they're not transmitting a disease. And even then, it's a little chancy
mm.
because the donor can transmit something that's not good.
Right.
And it's a little hit or miss because, you know, it's not like a probiotic, which is standardized. It's like one thing or a combination of known things. It's like a gamish of, like, hundreds, perhaps thousands of different organisms.
Right.
So, but it works. So the other thing that works, as you know, specific carbohydrate diet is very helpful for
mm-hmm.
it. It's really starving out the bad bacteria.
Yeah.
Saccharomyces boulardii.
Saccharomyces boulardii is wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But these days, anytime somebody takes antibiotics, and especially in a hospital setting, they should be given Saccharomyces. By the way, Saccharomyces is now on formulary in many hospitals.
Wow.
For C. difficile. It's recognized
Florastor.
That is helpful.
Yeah.
Florastor is the
yeah.
name of the,
yeah.
the
So the fecal transfer is actually re-inoculating the person's gut with healthy microbiota.
Right, so how it's done is it's either done via the oral route, but it's done in, encapsulated form.
Yes, please.
But more often, it's done. Sometimes it's done via endoscopy, like with a colonoscope, to sort of insert it up there.
Uh-huh.
Or
colonoscopy?
Yeah, right.
Rather than, okay.
Yeah, but sometimes, they actually term it poop pills,
Poop pills, yeah.
Which is a little icky. And so in the future, what they may do is they may actually come up with the right mix that they can, regulate and standardize. Because, it's hard. You can't call it a drug. Because a drug has standardized characteristics. It's sort of like, even a blood transfusion is much easier to characterize because there's only a few types of blood.
Yeah.
But
a poop pill is coming from one donor's unique microbiome.
Right. And there are actually people who are making enormous amounts of money. Not enormous, but, the people...
That's a great idea.
Successful poop donors that they give good results, that they become reliable donors.
Wow.
So can you imagine getting paid like $10,000 a year just to poop?
Wow, that could be a good side gig.
Yeah. I think we have.
I'd be into
it. Hey, listen, all the kimchi and probiotics that you
exactly.
eat.
Exactly. Oh my gosh.
You should try out.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So
Oh my goodness. I'm going to look into that.
I mean, it's easier than a guy becoming a sperm donor. so there's some money in that too. But.
Oh my goodness, Bo. We hope you feel better. Yeah. Okay. Hopefully that round of flagyl will do it for you. The next question is from Salisha. Hello, I hope all is well. I have had bad dysmenorrhea issues, and my gynecologist found a polyp and wants to do minor surgery to remove it. I've never had any kind of surgery before. What do you think?
Well,
Is it a minor surgery?
I have a little aphorism that I've coined. Is the only minor surgery is a surgery being performed on somebody else.
Ah.
That's the only minor surgery. So it's always a euphemism, and when it starts is when the doctor says, this won't hurt one bit.
Oh, boy.
And that's when they break the covenant with you, and that usually happens pretty early on. This isn't going to hurt at all. Oh, yeah. A polyp in the cervix is usually quite innocent, but sometimes it could conceal dangerous precancerous cells, so it has to be looked at. It's uterine or it's cervical?
She doesn't say. GYN found a polyp, so we're guessing here.
I think that's probably uterine. A cervical polyp is pretty common, but it's less likely to be cancerous. A uterine polyp could be a sign of a precancerous condition where it could be endometrial cancer. Mm-hmm. Now, did she also say something? Did I hear something about heavy periods?
Yes, dysmenorrhea.
Okay, so
bad cramping anyway.
Right, so here's the deal. This is often a sign of estrogen dominance. Mm-hmm. Excess estrogen causes a proliferation of the breast tissue, but also the endometrial tissue, leading to a higher risk of breast cancer, but also endometrial cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And short of cancer, how do you know that you have estrogen dominance? Well, often you're overweight. Often you have bad periods, heavy periods, cramping, a lot of breast tenderness, and heavy bleeding.
Yeah.
Because with excess estrogen and not enough progesterone, there's a proliferation of your endometrium, and or you could have fibroids.
Uterine fibroids are also a symptom of estrogen dominance.
Right. So that's a whole...
Fibrocystic breasts.
Right. Lumpy breasts, difficult to examine, painful breasts, and so on.
If I were Salisha, I'd go have that polyp removed if it were me.
So right there, yeah. I mean,
I would.
Got to do it.
Take care of it.
It is rather minor surgery, although it's like snip, snip internally.
This too shall pass.
And then it could also be, the endometrium could be sampled. You can get reassurance that everything is okay. You could get probably an endometrial biopsy at the same time. Make sure that it's okay.
Right.
So then, if she were to have precancerous changes or, we could draw a blood test for estrogen and progesterone, then we would want weight loss, exercise, lower carb diet,
some
calcium D-glucarate, Breveil, DIM.
DIM.
These are things that help that. And I've written articles on estrogen dominance, mm-hmm. which are quite popular.
Yes.
You know, they're on the internet.
Yes. Yeah. Salisha, you should go to drhoffman.com, and it's under the, like, most read or most popular there on the right side.
Don't get confused with the S&M websites, though, because estrogen dominance sometimes, you know, you think of, like, a woman with, like, leather boots and,
like,
a whip.
Dominatrix, yeah.
You know, but it's that's not what it is.
That's
it's
different.
It's a medical condition.
We hope you get better soon, Salisha. Thank you for your question. Okay. We've got another. Actually, we have a few questions here from this person. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I love your podcasts. I'm a 66-year-old male. I take my two Labrador retrievers to the park every day, running around while I tune you in. A few questions for you. Is stevia a safe sweetener alternative? Dr. Andrew Weil seems to give it his blessing.
Well, if Dr. Andrew Weil gives it his blessing, it's got to be good. You know.
Yeah.
No, but there actually had been some. You know, what's really interesting is that for a while, and I think this, I have a little conspiracy theory about this. The FDA did not approve stevia, and that was because there were some lingering questions about its safety.
Huh.
But I think the reason for that is because it was a competitor to the artificial sweeteners that were the major industrial
aspartame and sweeten low.
And then all of a sudden, it was like, it's safe. So now the Pepsi and Coca-Cola use stevia. They combine it with triolose and something called Truvia, because actually stevia doesn't taste that great on its own. It doesn't have such a natural sweet taste. I mean, it's cloyingly sweet, in my opinion. So it needs to be combined with something else.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can make a low or no-calorie sweetener.
However, the jury is out on if it impacts blood sugar or not. So I think anybody with blood sugar issues should just be wary, is all.
Yeah,
but otherwise, if I had to choose a sweetener or an artificial sweetener, it's not an artificial sweetener either. It's natural. You can grow it in your backyard.
It's natural, but it's a non-caloric sweetener.
Yes,
let's put it that way.
So in the sense
that it does create for the body the expectancy that there's going to be sugar, there is what's called a cerebral phase of blood sugar response.
Yes.
So when something sweet enters your mouth, you may have an insulin surge anyway.
Right. And remember, insulin is a fat storage hormone.
Yep.
After it does very important work.
We're not sure on that.
Right.
So, you know, I think the problem that people have is they want to eat their cake and have it.
Right.
They want to get away from sugar, but they want something sweet.
They want something sweet.
And I really, unfortunately, you got to stare the green-eyed monster in the face and, you know,
and say,
I'm
going to go do something else.
Yeah, but to the extent that you might go through some withdrawal or deprivation, unfortunately, but, you know.
Yeah. So, okay.
Or you could do like what I do, which is, you know, have a little, and I do have, you know, dark chocolate, which is sugary, and exercise like crazy.
There you go.
You know, pay it forward, you know.
Pay it forward, exactly. Another question from KR. I've got initials here. Any suggestions for menopause? My husband's been having night flashes for about 10 years.
Wait a minute. That's a switcheroo.
Yeah.
She's saying for her husband?
No. He's a 66-year-old male.
Oh.
This is for his wife, who's had night sweats for over 10 years.
Well, you read it wrong. You said husband's having hot flashes.
Oh, no.
Because it happens. You know, men who go on hormone treatments for prostate cancer, they get terrible hot flashes.
They get hot flashes.
Yeah.
Oh, no. This would be for his wife.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we know she's tried all the natural vitamins alternatives, but has she tried estrovera?
Right.
I wonder.
So what is estrovera?
It's a Siberian rhubarb. It's actually a Russian
product
rhubarb.
Product made by Metagenics, which is not available to the general public via retail stores, but can be ordered via the internet. We have it at drhoffman.com. And it's also safe from the standpoint of, does it have a hormonal effect? Some women are concerned, you know, if they've had breast cancer, that soy may be used for menopause, but it may have an estrogenic effect.
Right.
And so we, even red clover is a source of, isoflavones.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that's an isoflavone, that may be estrogenic, and it may help hot flashes, but it may also, if you not supposed to get any kind of estrogenic stimulus, you have estrogen receptor positive cancer, you may not want to take that. So we safely prescribe that. What also is helpful?
there's some basic things first. If KR's wife is having white foods like sugar and mm-hmm. white flour, and if she's having things like cola and diet sodas and red wine, and sorry, chocolate, these things can bring on a hot flash
and
later in the day or in the middle of the night.
Fluctuations in blood sugar, hypoglycemia will make you get into a hot sweat.
Caffeine can be a problem later on after menopause for many women, mm-hmm. so that could be something. Take a look at the diet first and clean up the diet. Make sure she's eating very clean. She's mm-hmm. not having caffeine or too many sweets or anything.
And alcohol that can cause flushing. Yeah.
Yes, alcohol, definitely. Red wine, right. especially. So.
And, so the other things that are helpful, St. John's wort is sometimes helpful because, they actually use Prozac for women who have hot flashes. And, it works on serotonin.
Oh,
and
it
does sort of blunt the hot flashes, but St. John's wort also works in a similar way. Mm. We can also use black cohosh. That seems to work for some women.
Sage tea.
Sage tea, which has an anti-sweating effect, it's an anti-diaphoretic. There's magnesium can mm-hmm. also be helpful. Evening primrose oil or black currant seed, mm-hmm. GLA, high-dose vitamin E, B6 sometimes can
high
be helpful.
High-dose vitamin E,
There's some studies with that. Generally we can tame this. And then, of course, exercise conditioning also helps you with, stabilizing the autonomic nervous system and giving you a little bit of heat conditioning.
KR has one last question.
We're going to be generous to KR.
Yeah. Is there anything that really helps arthritis in the hip? I've seen supplements that claim to build cartilage, but many think that's ridiculous. Well, it's not ridiculous. Glucosamine and chondroitin does work. However, my doctor has given me Serapin injections, and now we've graduated to a whole bunch of prolotherapy.
Okay, well, look, on the way to hip replacement, you kind of go through the various stations of the cross, and start with glucosamine, and take curcumin, boswellan, fish oil, shea butter oil, all these different things, and then you can try some interventions, you can try some injections, and then if all those fails, then unfortunately you got to go to. I mean, I'm the first one to admit this. Sometimes these oral vitamins and supplements aren't enough. The damage is too far gone,
mm-hmm.
and you have to get the hip replaced.
Okay.
So, I think we mentioned some of the things that are helpful, and she's trying some of the things that are helpful. The other thing that could be considered, and I did have a patient who reported some very good results with stem cell injections. But she said that the first time she tried stem cells, they pulled it out of her abdominal fat, and that was not as effective as when they actually went into the bone marrow, which is a little more... a little more invasive, and they pulled out some stem cells and they cultivated them in some way and they reinjected them into her hip, and she said it was curative for a long period of time. So
is it prime time for stem cells?
Not quite.
But that is so encouraging for joints. Yeah.
But if somebody says, "Look, you've got kidney failure, and you're going to need to get a kidney transplant," I'll just inject some stem cells in you, and we'll regenerate your kidneys.
Mm.
Not there yet for that. But direct application into joints, we're beginning to understand how that works and how to prepare the cells correctly. It's not just getting the cells; it's mm-hmm. preparing them in the right way so they grow into cartilage and synovial membrane.
Mm-hmm.
That's to train them to do what you need to. They're what are called pluripotential cells. They have plural means multiple, mm-hmm. potential means potentials. They have multiple potentials, but to coax them to go the direction you want them to go, that's the trick of stem cell replacement. So it's a great potential, but can we train and coax the cells to do what we want them to do? And then mm-hmm. there is actually there's some danger considerations, because stem cells are primitive cells that in some ways resemble cancer cells. They don't have checks mm-hmm. and balances, so they can proliferate. And I don't think there's accounts of people who've gotten too many stem cell treatments who've gotten widely proliferating cancer. But at least it's a theoretical concern. So that's why I don't think, I'm not ready to adopt the therapy myself, and I think that the claims for it are overblown.
Okay.
But for orthopedic purposes, I think we're beginning to see the point where it's worth a try, mm-hmm. On your way to a more radical procedure where they actually put in an artificial hip.
Yeah.
It's worth exploring.
Thank you, KR.
Okay, enough questions from KR.
Uh-huh.
But you got our money's worth today. So so that's all for today's edition of the Q&A with Layla. And look out for our video of our recent seminar at the Hoffman Center on food craving.
Mm-hmm.
And check out drhoffman.com for more informative content. Thanks for joining us today, Layla.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.